The Prisoner of Zenda. Chapter 1. The Rassendals with a word on the Elfbergs. I wonder when in the world you're going to do anything, Rudolf? Said my brother's wife. My dear Rose, I answered, laying down my egg spoon, why in the world should I do anything? My position is a comfortable one. I have an income nearly sufficient for my wants. No one's income is ever quite sufficient, you know. I enjoy an enviable social position. I am brother to Lord Burlston, and brother-in-law to that charming lady, his countess. Behold, it is enough. You are 29, she observed, and you've done nothing but knock about? It is true. Our family doesn't need to do things. This remark of mine rather annoyed Rose, for everybody knows, and therefore there can be no harm in referring to the fact, that, pretty and accomplished as she herself is, her family is hardly of the same standing as the Rassendals. Besides her attractions, she possessed a large fortune, and my brother Robert was wise enough not to mind about her ancestry. Ancestry is, in fact, a matter concerning which the next observation of Rose's has some truth. Good families are generally worse than any others, she said. Upon this I stroked my hair, I knew quite well what she meant. I'm so glad Robert's is black, she cried. At this moment Robert, who rises at 7 and works before breakfast, came in. He glanced at his wife, her cheek was slightly flushed, he patted it caressingly. What's the matter, my dear? He asked. She objects to my doing nothing and having red hair, said I, in an injured tone. Oh. Of course he can't help his hair, admitted Rose. It generally crops out once in a generation, said my brother. So does the nose. Rudolf has got them both. I wish they didn't crop out, said Rose, still flushed. I rather like them myself, said I, and, rising, I bowed to the portrait of Countess Amelia. My brother's wife uttered an exclamation of impatience. I wish you'd take that picture away, Robert, said she. My dear, he cried. Good heavens, I added. Then it might be forgotten, she continued. Hardly with Rudolf about, said Robert, shaking his head. Why should it be forgotten? I asked. Rudolf, exclaimed my brother's wife, blushing very prettily. I laughed, and went on with my egg. At least I had shelved the question of what, if anything, I ought to do. And, by way of closing the discussion and also, I must admit, of exasperating my strict little sister-in-law a trifle more I observed. I rather like being an Elfberg myself. When I read a story, I skip the explanations, yet the moment I begin to write one, I find that I must have an explanation. For it is manifest that I must explain why my sister-in-law was vexed with my nose and hair, and why I ventured to call myself an Elfberg. For eminent as, I must protest, the Rassendals have been for many generations, yet participation in their blood of course does not, at first sight, justify the boast of a connection with the grander stock of the Elfbergs or a claim to be one of that royal house. For what relationship is there between Ruritania and Burlston, between the palace at Strelsaw or the castle of Zenda and number 305 Park Lane, W? Well then and I must premise that I am going, perforce, to rake up the very scandal which my dear Lady Burlston wishes forgotten in the year 1733, George II. Sitting then on the throne, peace reigning for the moment, and the King and the Prince of Wales being not yet at loggerheads, there came on a visit to the English court a certain prince, who was afterwards known to history as Rudolf III of Ruritania. The prince was a tall, handsome young fellow, marked, maybe marred, it is not for me to say, by a somewhat unusually long, sharp and straight nose, and a mass of dark red hair in fact, the nose and the hair which have stamped the Elfbergs time out of mind. He stayed some months in England, where he was most courteously received, yet, in the end, he left rather under a cloud. For he fought a duel, it was considered highly well-bred of him to waive all question of his rank, with a nobleman, well-known in the society of the day, not only for his own merits, but as the husband of a very beautiful wife. In that duel Prince Rudolf received a severe wound, and, recovering therefrom, was adroitly smuggled off by the Ruritanian ambassador, who had found him a pretty handful. The nobleman was not wounded in the duel, but the morning being raw and damp on the occasion of the meeting, he contracted a severe chill, and, failing to throw it off, he died some 6 months after the departure of Prince Rudolf, without having found leisure to adjust his relations with his wife who, after another 2 months, bore an heir to the title and estates of the family of Burlston. This lady was the Countess Amelia, whose picture my sister-in-law wished to remove from the drawing room in Park Lane, and her husband was James, 5th Earl of Burlesdon and 22nd Baron Rassendyll, both in the Peerage of England, and a Knight of the Garter. As for Rudolf, he went back to Ruritania, married a wife, and ascended the throne, whereon his progeny in the direct line have sat from then till this very hour with one short interval. And, finally, if you walk through the picture galleries at Burlesdon, among the 50 portraits or so of the last century and a half, you will find 5 or 6, including that of the 6th Earl, distinguished by long, sharp, straight noses and a quantity of dark red hair. These 5 or 6 have also blue eyes, whereas among the Rassendylls dark eyes are the commoner. That is the explanation, and I am glad to have finished it. The blemishes on honorable lineage are a delicate subject, and certainly this heredity we hear so much about is the finest scandalmonger in the world. It laughs at discretion, and writes strange entries between the lines of the peerages. It will be observed that my sister-in-law, with a want of logic that must have been peculiar to herself, since we are no longer allowed to lay it to the charge of her sex, treated my complexion almost as an offense for which I was responsible, hastening to assume from that external sign inward qualities of which I protest my entire innocence, and this unjust inference she sought to buttress by pointing to the uselessness of the life I had led. Well, be that as it may, I had picked up a good deal of pleasure and a good deal of knowledge. I had been to a German school and a German university, and spoke German as readily and perfectly as English. I was thoroughly at home in French, I had a smattering of Italian and enough Spanish to swear by. I was, I believe, a strong, though hardly fine swordsman and a good shot. I could ride anything that had a back to sit on, and my head was as cool a one as you could find, for all its flaming cover. If you say that I ought to have spent my time in useful labor, I am out of court and have nothing to say, save that my parents had no business to leave me £2,000 a year and a roving disposition. The difference between you and Robert, said my sister-in-law, who often, bless her, speaks on a platform, and oftener still as if she were on one, is that he recognizes the duties of his position, and you see the opportunities of yours. To a man of spirit, my dear Rose, I answered, opportunities are duties. Nonsense, said she, tossing her head, and after a moment she went on, now, here's Sir Jacob Borrowdyle offering you exactly what you might be equal to. 1,000 thanks, I murmured. He's to have an embassy in 6 months, and Robert says he is sure that he'll take you as an attaché. Do take it, Rudolf, to please me. Now, when my sister-in-law puts the matter in that way, wrinkling her pretty brows, twisting her little hands, and growing wistful in the eyes, all on account of an idle scamp like myself, for whom she has no natural responsibility, I am visited with compunction. Moreover, I thought it possible that I could pass the time in the position suggested with some tolerable amusement. Therefore I said, my dear sister, if in 6 months' time no unforeseen obstacle has arisen, and Sir Jacob invites me, hang me if I don't go with Sir Jacob. Oh, Rudolf, how good of you. I am glad. Where's he going to? He doesn't know yet, but it's sure to be a good embassy. Madam, said I, for your sake I'll go, if it's no more than a beggarly legation. When I do a thing, I don't do it by halves. My promise, then, was given, but 6 months are 6 months, and seem an eternity, and, inasmuch as they stretched between me and my prospective industry, I suppose attaches are industrious, but I know not, for I never became attaché to Sir Jacob or anybody else, I cast about for some desirable mode of spending them. And it occurred to me suddenly that I would visit Ruritania. It may seem strange that I had never visited that country yet, but my father, in spite of a sneaking fondness for the Elfbergs, which led him to give me, his second son, the famous Elfberg name of Rudolf, had always been averse from my going, and, since his death, my brother, prompted by Rose, had accepted the family tradition which taught that a wide berth was to be given to that country. But the moment Ruritania had come into my head I was eaten up with a curiosity to see it. After all, red hair and long noses are not confined to the house of Elfberg, and the old story seemed a preposterously insufficient reason for debarring myself from acquaintance with a highly interesting and important kingdom, one which had played no small part in European history, and might do the like again under the sway of a young and vigorous ruler, such as the new king was rumored to be. My determination was clinched by reading in the Times that Rudolf V was to be crowned at Stralsa in the course of the next 3 weeks, and that great magnificence was to mark the occasion. At once I made up my mind to be present, and began my preparations. But, inasmuch as it has never been my practice to furnish my relatives with an itinerary of my journeys, and in this case I anticipated opposition to my wishes, I gave out that I was going for a ramble in the Tyrol, an old haunt of mine, and propitiated Rose's wrath by declaring that I intended to study the political and social problems of the interesting community which dwells in that neighborhood. Perhaps, I hinted darkly, there may be an outcome of the expedition. "What do you mean?" she asked. "Well," said I carelessly, "there seems a gap that might be filled by an exhaustive work on." "Oh! Will you write a book?" she cried, clapping her hands. "That would be splendid, wouldn't it, Robert?" "It's the best of introductions to political life nowadays," observed my brother, who has, by the way, introduced himself in this manner several times over. "Burlston on Ancient Theories and Modern Facts and the Ultimate Outcome, by a Political Student, are both works of recognized eminence." "I believe you are right, Bob, my boy," said I. "Now promise you'll do it," said Rose earnestly. "No, I won't promise, but if I find enough material, I will." "That's fair enough," said Robert. "Oh, material doesn't matter," she said, pouting. But this time she could get no more than a qualified promise out of me. To tell the truth, I would have wagered a handsome sum that the story of my expedition that summer would stain no paper and spoil not a single pen. And that shows how little we know what the future holds, for here I am, fulfilling my qualified promise, and writing, as I never thought to write, a book, though it will hardly serve as an introduction to political life, and has not a jot to do with the Tyrol. Neither would it, I fear, please Lady Burlston, if I were to submit it to her critical eye, a step which I have no intention of taking. Chapter 2. Concerning the color of men's hair. It was a maxim of my Uncle William's that no man should pass through Paris without spending 24 hours there. My uncle spoke out of a ripe experience of the world, and I honored his advice by putting up for a day and a night at the Continental on my way to the Tyrol. I called on George Featherly at the embassy, and we had a bit of dinner together at Durand's, and afterwards dropped into the opera, and after that we had a little supper, and after that we called on Bertram Bertrand, a versifier of some repute and Paris correspondent to the Critic. He had a very comfortable suite of rooms, and we found some pleasant fellows smoking and talking. It struck me, however, that Bertram himself was absent and in low spirits, and when everybody except ourselves had gone, I rallied him on his moping preoccupation. He fenced with me for a while, but at last, flinging himself on a sofa, he exclaimed, "Very well, have it your own way. I am in love, infernally in love." "Oh, you'll write the better poetry," said I, by way of consolation. He ruffled his hair with his hand and smoked furiously. George Featherly, standing with his back to the mantelpiece, smiled unkindly. "If it's the old affair," said he, "you may as well throw it up, Bert. She's leaving Paris tomorrow." "I know that," snapped Bertram. "Not that it would make any difference if she stayed," pursued the relentless George. "She flies higher than the paper trade, my boy." "Hang her," said Bertram. "It would make it more interesting for me, I venture to observe, if I knew who you were talking about." "Antoinette Maupin," said George. "The Maupin," growled Bertram. "Oh," said I, passing by the question of the duh. "You don't mean to say, Bert? Can't you let me alone?" "Where's she going to?" I asked, for the lady was something of a celebrity. George jingled his money, smiled cruelly at poor Bertram, and answered pleasantly, "Nobody knows. By the way, Bert, I met a great man at her house the other night, at least, about a month ago. Did you ever meet him, the Duke of Strelsau?" "Yes, I did," growled Bertram. "An extremely accomplished man, I thought him." It was not hard to see that George's references to the Duke were intended to aggravate poor Bertram's sufferings, so that I drew the inference that the Duke had distinguished Madame de Maupin by his attentions. She was a widow, rich, handsome, and, according to repute, ambitious. It was quite possible that she, as George put it, was flying as high as a personage who was everything he could be, short of enjoying strictly royal rank, for the Duke was the son of the late King of Ruritania by a second and morganatic marriage, and half-brother to the new king. He had been his father's favorite, and it had occasioned some unfavorable comment when he had been created a duke, with a title derived from no less a city than the capital itself. His mother had been of good, but not exalted, birth. "He's not in Paris now, is he?" I asked. "Oh no. He's gone back to be present at the king's coronation, a ceremony which, I should say, he'll not enjoy much. But, Bert, old man, Don't despair. He won't marry the fair Antoinette, at least, not unless another plan comes to nothing. Still, perhaps she. He paused and added, with a laugh, royal attentions are hard to resist, you know that, don't you, Rudolph? Confound you, said I, and rising, I left the hapless Bertram in George's hands and went home to bed. The next day George Featherly went with me to the station, where I took a ticket for Dresden. Going to see the pictures? Asked George, with a grin. George is an inveterate gossip, and had I told him that I was off to Ruritania, the news would have been in London in 3 days and in Park Lane in a week. I was, therefore, about to return an evasive answer, when he saved my conscience by leaving me suddenly and darting across the platform. Following him with my eyes, I saw him lift his hat and accost a graceful, fashionably dressed woman who had just appeared from the booking office. She was, perhaps, a year or two over 30, tall, dark, and of rather full figure. As George talked, I saw her glance at me, and my vanity was hurt by the thought that, muffled in a fur coat and a neck wrapper, for it was a chilly April day, and wearing a soft traveling hat pulled down to my ears, I must be looking very far from my best. A moment later, George rejoined me. You've got a charming traveling companion, he said. That's poor Bert Bertrand's goddess, Antoinette de Maupin, and, like you, she's going to Dresden also, no doubt, to see the pictures. It's very queer, though, that she doesn't at present desire the honor of your acquaintance. I didn't ask to be introduced, I observed, a little annoyed. Well, I offered to bring you to her, but she said, another time. Never mind, old fellow, perhaps there'll be a smash, and you'll have a chance of rescuing her and cutting out the Duke of Stralsund. No smash, however, happened, either to me or to Madame de Maupin. I can speak for her as confidently as for myself, for when, after a night's rest in Dresden, I continued my journey, she got into the same train. Understanding that she wished to be let alone, I avoided her carefully, but I saw that she went the same way as I did to the very end of my journey, and I took opportunities of having a good look at her, when I could do so unobserved. As soon as we reached the Ruritanian frontier, where the old officer who presided over the custom house favored me with such a stare that I felt surer than before of my Elfberg physiognomy, I bought the papers, and found in them news which affected my movements. For some reason, which was not clearly explained, and seemed to be something of a mystery, the date of the coronation had been suddenly advanced, and the ceremony was to take place on the next day but one. The whole country seemed in a stir about it, and it was evident that Stralsund was thronged. Rooms were all let and hotels overflowing, there would be very little chance of my obtaining a lodging, and I should certainly have to pay an exorbitant charge for it. I made up my mind to stop at Zenda, a small town 50 miles short of the capital, and about 10 from the frontier. My train reached there in the evening. I would spend the next day, Tuesday, in a wander over the hills, which were said to be very fine, and in taking a glance at the famous castle, and go over by train to Stralsund on the Wednesday morning, returning at night to sleep at Zenda. Accordingly at Zenda I got out, and as the train passed where I stood on the platform, I saw my friend Madame de Maupin in her place. Clearly she was going through to Stralsund, having, with more providence than I could boast, secured apartments there. I smiled to think how surprised George Featherly would have been to know that she and I had been fellow travelers for so long. I was very kindly received at the hotel. It was really no more than an inn kept by a fat old lady and her two daughters. They were good, quiet people, and seemed very little interested in the great doings at Stralsund. The old lady's hero was the Duke, for he was now, under the late King's will, master of the Zenda estates and of the castle, which rose grandly on its steep hill at the end of the valley a mile or so from the inn. The old lady, indeed, did not hesitate to express regret that the Duke was not on the throne, instead of his brother. We know Duke Michael, said she. He has always lived among us, every Ruritanian knows Duke Michael. But the king is almost a stranger, he has been so much abroad, not one in 10 knows him even by sight. And now, chimed in one of the young women, they say he has shaved off his beard, so that no one at all knows him. Shaved his beard! Exclaimed her mother. Who says so? Johann, the Duke's keeper. He has seen the king. Ah, yes. The king, sir, is now at the Duke's hunting lodge in the forest here. From here he goes to Stralsund to be crowned on Wednesday morning. I was interested to hear this, and made up my mind to walk next day in the direction of the lodge, on the chance of coming across the king. The old lady ran on garrulously. Ah, and I wish he would stay at his hunting that and wine, and one thing more, are all he loves, they say, and suffer our duke to be crowned on Wednesday. That I wish, and I don't care who knows it. Hush, mother, urged the daughters. Oh, there's many to think as I do, cried the old woman stubbornly. I threw myself back in my deep armchair, and laughed at her zeal. For my part, said the younger and prettier of the two daughters, a fair, buxom, smiling wench, I hate Black Michael. A red Elfberg for me, mother. The king, they say, is as red as a fox or as. And she laughed mischievously as she cast a glance at me, and tossed her head at her sister's reproving face. Many a man has cursed their red hair before now, muttered the old lady, and I remembered James, 5th Earl of Burlesdon. But never a woman, cried the girl. Ay, and women, when it was too late, was the stern answer, reducing the girl to silence and blushes. How comes the king here? I asked, to break an embarrassed silence. It is the duke's land here, you say. The duke invited him, sir, to rest here till Wednesday. The duke is at Strelsaw, preparing the king's reception. Then their friends? None better, said the old lady. But my rosy damsel tossed her head again, she was not to be repressed for long, and she broke out again. Ay, they love one another as men do who want the same place and the same wife. The old woman glowered, but the last words pricked my curiosity, and I interposed before she could begin scolding. What, the same wife, too? How's that, young lady? All the world knows that Black Michael. Well then, mother, the duke would give his soul to marry his cousin, the Princess Flavia, and that she is to be the queen. Upon my word, said I begin to be sorry for your duke. But if a man will be a younger son, why he must take what the elder leaves, and be as thankful to God as he can. And, thinking of myself, I shrugged my shoulders and laughed. And then I thought also of Antoinette de Mauban and her journey to Strelsaw. It's little dealing Black Michael has with, began the girl, braving her mother's anger, but as she spoke a heavy step sounded on the floor, and a gruff voice asked in a threatening tone. Who talks of Black Michael and His Highness's own burg? The girl gave a little shriek, half of fright, half, I think, of amusement. You'll not tell of me, Johann? She said. See where your chatter leads, said the old lady. The man who had spoken came forward. We have company, Johann, said my hostess, and the fellow plucked off his cap. A moment later he saw me, and, to my amazement, he started back a step, as though he had seen something wonderful. What ails you, Johann? Asked the elder girl. This is a gentleman on his travels, come to see the coronation. The man had recovered himself, but he was staring at me with an intense, searching, almost fierce glance. Good evening to you, said I. Good evening, sir, he muttered, still scrutinizing me, and the merry girl began to laugh as she called. See, Johann, it is the color you love. He started to see your hair, sir. It's not the color we see most of here in Zenda. I crave your pardon, sir, stammered the fellow, with puzzled eyes. I expected to see no one. Give him a glass to drink my health in, and I'll bid you good night, and thanks to you, ladies, for your courtesy and pleasant conversation. So speaking, I rose to my feet, and with a slight bow turned to the door. The young girl ran to light me on the way, and the man fell back to let me pass, his eyes still fixed on me. The moment I was by, he started a step forward, asking. Pray, sir, do you know our king? I never saw him, said I. I hope to do so on Wednesday. He said no more, but I felt his eyes following me till the door closed behind me. My saucy conductor, looking over her shoulder at me as she preceded me upstairs, said. There's no pleasing Master Johann for one of your color, sir. He prefers yours, maybe? I suggested. I meant, sir, in a man, she answered, with a coquettish glance. What, asked I, taking hold of the other side of the candlestick, does color matter in a man? Nay, but I love yours, it's the Elfberg red. Color in a man, said I, is a matter of no more moment than that. And I gave her something of no value. God send the kitchen door be shut, said she. Amen, said I, and left her. In fact, however, as I now know, color is sometimes of considerable moment to a man. Chapter 3. A merry evening with a distant relative. I was not so unreasonable as to be prejudiced against the duke's keeper because he disliked my complexion, and if I had been, his most civil and obliging conduct, as it seemed to me to be, next morning would have disarmed me. Hearing that I was bound for Stralsund, he came to see me while I was breakfasting, and told me that a sister of his who had married a well-to-do tradesman and lived in the capital, had invited him to occupy a room in her house. He had gladly accepted, but now found that his duties would not permit of his absence. He begged therefore that, if such humble, though, as he added, clean and comfortable, lodgings would satisfy me, I would take his place. He pledged his sister's acquiescence, and urged the inconvenience and crowding to which I should be subject in my journeys to and from Stralsund the next day. I accepted his offer without a moment's hesitation, and he went off to telegraph to his sister, while I packed up and prepared to take the next train. But I still hankered after the forest and the hunting lodge, and when my little maid told me that I could, by walking 10 miles or so through the forest, hit the railway at a roadside station, I decided to send my luggage direct to the address which Johann had given, take my walk, and follow to Stralsund myself. Johann had gone off and was not aware of the change in my plans, but, as its only effect was to delay my arrival at his sister's for a few hours, there was no reason for troubling to inform him of it. Doubtless the good lady would waste no anxiety on my account. I took an early luncheon, and, having bidden my kind entertainers farewell, promising to return to them on my way home, I set out to climb the hill that led to the castle, and thence to the forest of Zenda. Half an hour's leisurely walking brought me to the castle. It had been a fortress in old days, and the ancient keep was still in good preservation and very imposing. Behind it stood another portion of the original castle, and behind that again, and separated from it by a deep and broad moat, which ran all round the old buildings, was a handsome modern chateau, erected by the last king, and now forming the country residence of the Duke of Stralsund. The old and the new portions were connected by a drawbridge, and this indirect mode of access formed the only passage between the old building and the outer world, but leading to the modern chateau there was a broad and handsome avenue. It was an ideal residence. When Black Michael desired company, he could dwell in his chateau. If a fit of misanthropy seized him, he had merely to cross the bridge and draw it up after him. It ran on rollers, and nothing short of a regiment and a train of artillery could fetch him out. I went on my way, glad that poor Black Michael, though he could not have the throne or the princess, had, at least, as fine a residence as any prince in Europe. Soon I entered the forest, and walked on for an hour or more in its cool somber shade. The great trees enlaced with one another over my head, and the sunshine stole through in patches as bright as diamonds, and hardly bigger. I was enchanted with the place, and, finding a felled tree trunk, propped my back against it, and stretching my legs out gave myself up to undisturbed contemplation of the solemn beauty of the woods and to the comfort of a good cigar. And when the cigar was finished and I had, I suppose, inhaled as much beauty as I could, I went off into the most delightful sleep, regardless of my train to Stralsund and of the fast waning afternoon. To remember a train in such a spot would have been rank sacrilege. Instead of that, I fell to dreaming that I was married to the Princess Flavia and dwelt in the castle of Zenda, and beguiled whole days with my love in the glades of the forest, which made a very pleasant dream. In fact, I was just impressing a fervent kiss on the charming lips of the princess, when I heard, and the voice seemed at first a part of the dream, someone exclaim, in rough strident tones, "Why, the devil's in it. Shave him, and he'd be the king." The idea seemed whimsical enough for a dream. By the sacrifice of my heavy mustache and carefully pointed imperial, I was to be transformed into a monarch. I was about to kiss the princess again, when I arrived, very reluctantly, at the conclusion that I was awake. I opened my eyes, and found two men regarding me with much curiosity. Both wore shooting costumes and carried guns. One was rather short and very stoutly built, with a big bullet-shaped head, a bristly gray mustache, and small pale blue eyes, a trifle bloodshot. The other was a slender young fellow, of middle height, dark in complexion, and bearing himself with grace and distinction. I set the one down as an old soldier, the other for a gentleman accustomed to move in good society, but not unused to military life either. It turned out afterwards that my guess was a good one. The elder man approached me, beckoning the younger to follow. He did so, courteously raising his hat. I rose slowly to my feet. "He's the height, too," I heard the elder murmur, as he surveyed my 6 feet 2 inches of stature. Then, with a cavalier touch of the cap, he addressed me. "May I ask your name?" "As you have taken the first step in the acquaintance, gentlemen," said I, with a smile, "suppose you give me a lead in the matter of names." The young man stepped forward with a pleasant smile. "This," said he, "is Colonel Sapt, and I am called Fritz von Tarlenheim. We are both in the service of the King of Ruritania." I bowed and, baring my head, answered. I am Rudolf Rassendyll. I am a traveler from England, and once for a year or two I held a commission from Her Majesty the Queen. Then we are all brethren of the sword, answered Tarlenheim, holding out his hand, which I took readily. Rassendyll, Rassendyll, muttered Colonel Sapt, then a gleam of intelligence flitted across his face. By heaven! He cried, you're of the Birlstones? My brother is now Lord Birlstone, said I. Thy head betrayeth thee, he chuckled, pointing to my uncovered poll. Why, Fritz, you know the story. The young man glanced apologetically at me. He felt the delicacy which my sister-in-law would have admired. To put him at his ease, I remarked with a smile. Ah! The story is known here as well as among us, it seems. Known! Cried Sapt. If you stay here, the deuce a man in all Ruritania will doubt of it or a woman either. I began to feel uncomfortable. Had I realized what a very plainly written pedigree I carried about with me, I should have thought long before I visited Ruritania. However, I was in for it now. At this moment a ringing voice sounded from the wood behind us. Fritz, Fritz! Where are you, man? Tarlenheim started, and said hastily. It's the king. Old Sapt chuckled again. Then a young man jumped out from behind the trunk of a tree and stood beside us. As I looked at him, I uttered an astonished cry, and he, seeing me, drew back in sudden wonder. Saving the hair on my face and the manner of conscious dignity which his position gave him, saving also that he lacked perhaps half an inch, nay, less than that, but still something of my height, the king of Ruritania might have been Rudolf Rassendyll, and I, Rudolf, the king. For an instant we stood motionless, looking at one another. Then I bared my head again and bowed respectfully. The king found his voice, and asked in bewilderment. Colonel Fritz, who is this gentleman? I was about to answer, when Colonel Sapt stepped between the king and me, and began to talk to his majesty in a low growl. The king towered over Sapt, and, as he listened, his eyes now and again sought mine. I looked at him long and carefully. The likeness was certainly astonishing, though I saw the points of difference also. The king's face was slightly more fleshy than mine, the oval of its contour the least trifle more pronounced, and, as I fancied, his mouth lacking something of the firmness, or obstinacy, which was to be gathered from my close-shutting lips. But, for all that, and above all minor distinctions, the likeness rose striking, salient, wonderful. Sapt ceased speaking, and the king still frowned. Then, gradually, the corners of his mouth began to twitch, his nose came down, as mine does when I laugh, his eyes twinkled, and, behold, he burst into the merriest fit of irrepressible laughter, which rang through the woods and proclaimed him a jovial soul. Well met, cousin! He cried, stepping up to me, clapping me on the back, and laughing still. You must forgive me if I was taken aback. A man doesn't expect to see devil at this time of day, eh, Fritz? I must pray pardon, sire, for my presumption, said I. I trust it will not forfeit your majesty's favor. By heaven! You'll always enjoy the king's countenance, he laughed, whether I like it or not, and, sir, I shall very gladly add to it what services I can. Where are you traveling to? To Strelsaw, sire, to the coronation. The king looked at his friends, he still smiled, though his expression hinted some uneasiness. But the humorous side of the matter caught him again. Fritz, Fritz! He cried, a thousand crowns for a sight of Brother Michael's face when he sees a pair of us. And the merry laugh rang out again. Seriously, observed Fritz von Tarlenheim, I question Mr. Rassendyll's wisdom in visiting Strelsaw just now. The king lit a cigarette. Well, Sapt, said he, questioningly. He mustn't go, growled the old fellow. Come, Colonel, you mean that I should be in Mr. Rassendyll's debt, if... Oh, eh. Wrap it up in the right way, said Sapt, hauling a great pipe out of his pocket. Enough, sire, said I. I'll leave Ruritania today. No, by thunder, you shan't in that sans phrase, as Sapt likes it. For you shall dine with me tonight, happen what will afterwards. Come, man, you don't meet a new relation every day. We dine sparingly tonight, said Fritz von Tarlenheim. Not we with our new cousin for a guest, cried the king, and, as Fritz shrugged his shoulders, he added, oh, I'll remember our early start, Fritz. So will I tomorrow morning, said old Sapt, pulling at his pipe. Oh, wise old Sapt! Cried the king. Come, Mr. Rassendyll, by the way, what name did they give you?
Your Majesties, I answered, bowing.
Well, that shows they weren't ashamed of us, he laughed. Come, then, Cousin Rudolph, I've got no house of my own here, but my dear brother Michael lends us a place of his, and we'll make shift to entertain you there, and he put his arm through mine and, signing to the others to accompany us, walked me off, westerly, through the forest. We walked for more than half an hour, and the king smoked cigarettes and chattered incessantly. He was full of interest in my family, laughed heartily when I told him of the portraits with Elfberg hair in our galleries, and yet more heartily when he heard that my expedition to Ruritania was a secret one. You have to visit your disreputable cousin on the sly, have you? Said he. Suddenly emerging from the wood, we came on a small and rude hunting lodge. It was a one-story building, a sort of bungalow, built entirely of wood. As we approached it, a little man in a plain livery came out to meet us. The only other person I saw about the place was a fat elderly woman, whom I afterwards discovered to be the mother of Johann, the Duke's keeper. Well, is dinner ready, Joseph? Asked the king. The little servant informed us that it was, and we soon sat down to a plentiful meal. The fare was plain enough, the king ate heartily, Fritz von Tarlenheim delicately, old Sapp voraciously. I played a good knife and fork, as my custom is, the king noticed my performance with approval. We're all good trenchermen, we Elfbergs, said he. But what? We're eating dry. Wine, Joseph. Wine, man. Are we beasts, to eat without drinking? Are we cattle, Joseph? At this reproof Joseph hastened to load the table with bottles. Remember tomorrow, said Fritz. A tomorrow, said old Sapt. The king drained a bumper to his cousin Rudolph, as he was gracious or merry enough to call me, and I drank its fellow to the Elfberg Red, whereat he laughed loudly. Now, be the meat what it might, the wine we drank was beyond all price or praise, and we did it justice. Fritz ventured once to stay the king's hand. What? Cried the king. Remember you start before I do, Master Fritz, you must be more sparing by 2 hours than I. Fritz saw that I did not understand. The colonel and I, he explained, leave here at 6, we ride down to Zenda and return with the guard of honor to fetch the king at 8, and then we all ride together to the station. Hang that same guard. Growled Sapt. Oh. It's very civil of my brother to ask the honor for his regiment, said the king. Come, cousin, you need not start early. Another bottle, man. I had another bottle or, rather, a part of one, for the larger half traveled quickly down his majesty's throat. Fritz gave up his attempts at persuasion, from persuading, he fell to being persuaded, and soon we were all of us as full of wine as we had any right to be. The king began talking of what he would do in the future, old Sapt of what he had done in the past, Fritz of some beautiful girl or other, and I of the wonderful merits of the Elfberg dynasty. We all talked at once, and followed to the letter Sapt's exhortation to let the morrow take care of itself. At last the king set down his glass and leant back in his chair. I have drunk enough, said he. Far be it from me to contradict the king, said I. Indeed, his remark was most absolutely true so far as it went. While I yet spoke, Joseph came and set before the king a marvelous old wicker-covered flagon. It had lain so long in some darkened cellar that it seemed to blink in the candlelight. His Highness the Duke of Strelsau bade me set this wine before the king, when the king was weary of all other wines, and pray the king to drink, for the love that he bears his brother. Well done, Black Michael, said the king. Out with the cork, Joseph. Hang him. Did he think I'd flinch from his bottle? The bottle was opened, and Joseph filled the king's glass. The king tasted it. Then, with the solemnity born of the hour in his own condition, he looked round on us. Gentlemen, my friends Rudolph, my cousin, 'tis a scandalous story, Rudolph, on my honor, everything is yours to the half of Ruritania. But ask me not for a single drop of this divine bottle, which I will drink to the health of that sly knave, my brother, Black Michael. And the king seized the bottle and turned it over his mouth, and drained it and flung it from him, and laid his head on his arms on the table. And we drank pleasant dreams to his majesty, and that is all I remember of the evening. Perhaps it is enough. Chapter 4. The king keeps his appointment. Whether I had slept a minute or a year I knew not. I awoke with a start and a shiver, my face, hair and clothes dripped water, and opposite me stood old Sapt, a sneering smile on his face and an empty bucket in his hand. On the table by him sat Fritz von Tarlenheim,
pale as a ghost and black as a crow under the eyes. I leapt to my feet in anger. "Your joke goes too far, sir," I cried.
"Tut, man, we've no time for quarreling. Nothing else would rouse you. It's 5 o'clock.
"I'll thank you, Colonel Sapt," I began again, hot in spirit, though I was uncommonly cold in body.
"Rassendyll," interrupted Fritz, getting down from the table and taking my arm, "look here." The king lay full length on the floor. His face was red as his hair, and he breathed heavily. Sapt, the disrespectful old dog, kicked him sharply. He did not stir, nor was there any break in his breathing. I saw that his face and head were wet with water, as were mine.
"We've spent half an hour on him," said Fritz.
"He drank 3 times what either of you did," growled Sapt. I knelt down and felt his pulse. It was alarmingly languid and slow. We three looked at one another.
"Was it drugged, that last bottle?" I asked in a whisper.
"I don't know," said Sapt. "We must get a doctor. There's none within 10 miles, and 1,000 doctors wouldn't take him to Stralsund today. I know the look of it. He'll not move for 6 or 7 hours yet."
"But the coronation," I cried in horror.
Fritz shrugged his shoulders, as I began to see was his habit on most occasions.
"We must send word that he's ill," he said.
"I suppose so," said I. Old Sapt, who seemed as fresh as a daisy, had lit his pipe and was puffing hard at it. "If he's not crowned today," said he, "I'll lay a crown he's never crowned."
"But heavens, why?
The whole nation's there to meet him, half the army, and Black Michael at the head. Shall we send word that the king's drunk?"
"That he's ill," said I, in correction.
"Ill," echoed Sapt, with a scornful laugh. "They know his illnesses too well. He's been ill before."
"Well, we must chance what they think," said Fritz helplessly. "I'll carry the news and make the best of it."
Sapt raised his hand. "Tell me," said he. "Do you think the king was drugged?"
"I do," said I.
"And who drugged him?"
"That damned hound, Black Michael," said Fritz between his teeth.
"Eh," said Sapt, "that he might not come to be crowned. Rassendyll here doesn't know our pretty Michael. What think you, Fritz, has Michael no king ready? Has half Stralsund no other candidate? As God's alive, man, the throne's lost if the king show himself not in Stralsund today. I know Black Michael."
"We could carry him there," said I.
"And a very pretty picture he makes," sneered Sapt.
Fritz von Tarlin